You are Locked On Texans, your daily Houston Texans podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
We've got a real treat for you in today's show. The original and still voice of the Houston Texans, Mark Vandermeer, joins me for the first of a two-part conversation. You might learn a few things about Vandermeer that you didn't already know, or at least we hope so. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Robert Land from the Houston Sports Talk Podcast. My co-host, Brian Patterson, taking the day off. Thanks for jumping on the Locked On Texans Podcast, your best daily source of Texans news, views, and interviews. We're part of the FanRag Sports Network. And guys, last summer, I caught up with Mark Vandermeer. What a cool conversation with him. I asked him about everything from his days calling Andre Johnson's games at Miami to how his catchphrase rock and roll came about. Without further ado, here's the first part of that conversation. Well, it's only fitting that we're here underneath the bowels of the NRG Stadium in the media room. We've got the Texans photos all around us up on the wall. I'm here with Mark Vandermeer. I say it's fitting because 15 years now, you've been the voice of the Texans. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, it seems like time flies by, because I remember that very first year when you started this.
Yeah, it seems like it was about 2 years ago, but it's 15 years ago. And it's funny because for me, all the different places I've worked, obviously I've been here the longest. And when it started to get around 5, 6, 7 years, it just seemed like it was all one big, I don't know, prolonged period of working somewhere that was a lot like the other places I've worked, which were 3 or 4 year stops. And it's just gone by so fast. So when you look back, it does seem incredibly quick. But then you look at all the games and all the history, and there's a lot that's taken place. And I hope, you know, a lot more for me.
You talk Texans all the time, so I'm going to try to come up with some maybe angles that you don't have. And I want to start a little about just about your life and your career, and kind of leading up to being the Texans' voice. Vander Kid. Let's talk about Vander Kid.
Yeah.
Young Mark Vandermeer. What was he like? Was he a big football fan?
Me. I thought you meant my actual kid.
No. I'm talking about the little Mark Vandermeer.
Yeah, that's all right. So I was not a sports fan as a kid, and I haven't talked about this much, but I have a little bit. I grew up wanting to be a rock star, playing guitar, writing songs, really put all my time and passion into that in high school early on, and continued to do so. And then in college is where I really caught fire with sports. In high school, honestly, I couldn't even tell you who was in the playoffs. I could probably tell you who was in the Super Bowl only because, you know, you have to be under a rock to not know that. But seriously, I really didn't watch football. I did not know the game of football until I went to college my freshman year at Boston University, overlooking the field, watching games, asking the most basic questions to my roommate, who later at my wedding rehearsal dinner would tell the story and just make people howl that I was like so unknowledgeable about football. But within a year of my freshman year, of the fall of freshman year, I was an NFL expert. You know, I dove right in, because not only just watching college football on the field there at Boston University and being curious about it, but then watching NFL football, especially the primetime game Monday night, and I saw it as entertainment. I said, this is really cool. This is really great stuff. I mean, it was all brand new to me. It really was all brand new. I'd never really checked it out. I came from a European family, European parents. They really weren't huge sports fans. And I just dove right in. And then I discovered they write articles about this stuff in the newspaper. Did you know this? I mean, it was a whole big world of discovery to me. And then I started reading Pro Football Weekly. I dove in big. So within a year or two, I knew everything there was to know about the NFL. I just inhaled information about the league.
So you didn't even have a team, a favorite team growing up,
no,
NFL team or anything like that?
The first team I fell in love with, actually, so it's funny because it sounds horrible being who I am, but when you are not familiar with pro football and it's almost like I was a foreigner coming in and just seeing this for the first time, the Cowboys catch your eye back then because it was Tony Dorsett. Danny White was already playing quarterback for them. And they caught my eye. I thought, this is a pretty cool kind of team. You know, this guy in the fedora and the suit. And, you know, they look different from everybody else. But I quickly steered myself away from them because I saw the San Diego Chargers play a Monday night game. And that was the team that I fell in love with at first sight. Dan Fouts, the San Diego Chargers Air Coryell attack with Chuck Muncy running the ball and James Brooks out of the backfield and Wes Chandler catching passes. John Jefferson was already gone. Kellen Winslow, Charlie Joyner. Those players just caught my eye and I fell deeply in love with the Chargers. I'd never even been to San Diego. Fouts to me was different because he was kind of clunky looking the way he backpedaled. The ball was not, if you look at Fouts' highlights, the ball is very rarely a perfect spiral. Kind of came out quacking a little bit, but it would always get there. Not always, because he did throw a bunch of picks, especially four against the Oilers in the 79 season playoffs. But that was, again, before I fell in love with him. This is the 81 season, which was a heck of a season to jump into the NFL because Montana came alive that year and the Bengals, you know, went to the Super Bowl and everything. But, yeah, the Chargers were my team for the first two or three years. The Patriots were terrible then, and I was living in Boston, but I was definitely keeping tabs on them because they were the local team, but they were terrible then. Steve Grogan was going through a bad time. He would later resurrect his career in the mid-80s. I think they had Matt Kavanaugh quarterback too. I mean, it was a weird team, and they fired Chuck Fairbanks and hired Ron Meyer, who I've actually, you know, we're great friends, my wife and I, with his daughter. So I've met Ron Meyer many times and talked to him and played golf with him. And I don't know, I'm kind of rambling, but I figured this is the format to do it. But yeah, the Chargers were it. Patriots a little bit. I hate the Patriots now like poison. I mean, the last Patriot team I think rooted for was quarterbacked by Drew Bledsoe in the mid-90s. That was it. And I was never really a big, huge Patriots fan, but they were the local team, so I kind of gravitated toward them a little bit in the early days.
Yeah, and I was a Charger guy too, and I also loved those teams because they were so exciting. And of course, I remember the four-interception game by Vernon Perry in the playoffs, but the Chargers also had the great game with the Dolphins where yeah. Kellen Winslow is almost carried off the field. You would later call his son's games, which I want to get to in a second, but you're from Rye, New York. You go to Boston University like you talked about. Then you did the Central Michigan games at that point. Then you go to UMass from 95 to 99, and so you're calling football, basketball, baseball, all the teams. And I wanted to ask you about that because those are the Coach Cal years. That's where he makes his name. And I remember specifically because me and you were at the same Sweet 16 in 96, I would think, if you were at the Sweet 16 when they were there for the Final Four run, and they played a young Allen Iverson.
Yeah, they did in the regional final to get to the Final Four. And that was a heck of a game. I think they held Iverson to 6-for-24 shooting. Those are the numbers that jump out to me. They were really good against Iverson because Camby was so terrific in the paint. I mean, he swatted everything away. He was a tremendous player both ends of the floor. He was, you know, he was the Heisman Trophy winner equivalent in college basketball that year. That was my first year at UMass. So my first year at UMass was Calipari's last year. And I was at Central Michigan the year before, 3 years before that. But the year before, Central Michigan's basketball team went 3-23. And then the next year, I'm on a team that goes 35-2. So it was a completely different situation. To get the UMass job was such a thrill because when I left Boston and embarked on this radio career thing, because I was not in radio full time as a broadcaster when I lived in Boston in my early 20s. I kind of had a career change at 25, but I had this career cathartic experience of sorts. And when I left Boston to start my radio career, I thought, I didn't know I was going to get back. You know, you look back on life, it's like, hey, things work out, but you just don't know. I didn't know I was going to get back to Massachusetts. And when I left Massachusetts, UMass was nothing. When I get back, they are the only thing almost. The Celtics were bad. The Bruins were bad. The Red Sox are always tremendous. And the Patriots just hired Bill Parcells. They were starting to come along. But they still, to me, were not even close to the Red Sox in stature you know, while Parcells was bringing up the Patriots. So UMass, in the winter anyway, was on the cover of the Globe sports section every day. I mean, this was a world that I was not even familiar with, being a Boston guy, so to speak. But here they were, and to have that job, to get that job, which was, you know, one of the greatest things I've been able to do is just get the job at UMass. To get the job and then all of a sudden be doing games. We played Boston College at the Fleet Center, which is the, you know, they call it the Garden now, but it's not the real Garden. It wasn't. It's not. The real Garden is the real Garden. They tore it down. Anyway, but we played Boston College there, and it was like the Red River Shootout. You know, it was half and half. It was half Boston College, half UMass. Building was packed. It was an amazing game on WBZ in Boston, this blowtorch station that reaches 30 states. You know, it was like it blew my mind to be part of that. I felt like I could not possibly make it any bigger than that. It was so thrilling to participate. And I still have when we go play the Patriots and I'm in the press box, people come up to me and talk about UMass. You know, that's how they know me. Oh, you were the voice of UMass. Like, not Miami, UMass. And now, oh, yeah, now you're with the Texans. But to them, that's such a big deal, that little slice of history when Calipari was there. And now, you know, you do the 30 for 30 on it and all this other stuff. But, yeah, it was very real and very cool.
The NCAA actually erased that year of your life.
Yeah, they did. I always say this. You know, the sponsors paid the advertising bills because I sold all the advertising for the UMass radio network back then, or like 90% of it. And I always thought of that. I was thinking, well, we collected those checks, you know, and Calipari collected his. Like, nobody had to return money other than Camby. He didn't even have to do it, but he did. He actually paid the university's fee to the NCAA of the NCAA tournament earnings, which was pretty cool of him. After all, he took the money from agents.
Last thing I knew, Marcus Camby was running a haircut place out in Pearland, so he's around here. You guys are in the same place.
I know. And you know what? I've never, like, I don't even know if he would know who I was, because I was there that one year, and we met, but it was so, that year, we had all this national media around, all this Boston media around, and I was brand new. I barely got to see him. I don't even know if I ever actually formally interviewed him. I mean, Calipari and I, you know, obviously we go back, but that was a very strange year and a lot of pressure on him. He handled it, you know, the off-court stuff, didn't handle it as well as he could, but, you know, look at the career he's had. He's you know, Houstonian. How about that? Marcus Camby, it's terrific.
Mark, let me quickly remind our listeners that if you're enjoying Locked On Texans, tell your friends, let them know they can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, most anywhere. You'll find your favorite podcast. If you'd like to check out more podcasts from our national Locked On Network, go to LockedOnSports.com, our new national Locked On Network website. We have podcasts for nearly every NFL and NBA team, plus the Locked On NFL Draft and Locked On NFL shows as well. It's all on LockedOnSports.com. That's LockedOnSports.com. Your charmed career continues because you walk over to the Miami Hurricanes, 2001 national championship team. 38 players would end up being selected in the NFL draft. I read at last count, as of 2013, they had a combined 43 trips to the Super Bowl between all of those guys.
Wow.
The names, I'm going to rattle them off. Clinton Portis. We talked about Kellen Winslow, Sean Taylor, Frank Gore, Willis McGahee, Bryant McKinney, Antrell Roll, Jonathan Vilma. And to my count, six of those guys eventually had a stint here with the Texans: Philip Buchanan, Rashard Butler, Chris Myers, and then the last three should all be future Hall of Famers, I'm thinking, and Vince Wilfork, Ed Reed, and Andre Johnson. Was it obvious you were witnessing something really special going on right there?
Yes. I don't think as special when you go over the NFL effect. I don't think as special as it would eventually become. We knew it was special, but we didn't know it was that special. We knew there was a lot of talent there. And I got that job. I mean, there's a whole other, you know, subtopic here in the way I got these jobs. You know, I got the UMass job. There was no job, and I was able to get a job because I pitched them a position. I said, I'll do your advertising sales, and I'll do the broadcasting. I'll do both. And they created the position for me and actually let go of the play-by-play guy at the time, which I didn't feel good about, but I didn't feel that bad about it either because I got the job. And the Miami Hurricanes opened up because Sonny Hirsch, who's a legend down there, who had done the games for many years, died, actually. Now, he was only doing color later in his career. They switched stations, and I found out from a friend of mine, Bill Roth, who was the voice of Virginia Tech for many years, that job was open. So I decided I was going to go down and pursue that job with a vengeance. And, you know, I tell the story a lot to people because, you know, it shows you what it takes to get gigs in this business. Very hard, you know, and people ask me all the time, well, you know, what do I do? Well, I sent, at the time, we didn't have email of links, you know, email existed, but this is the late 90s. You didn't email links of your work. You sent CDs and DVDs still, you know, DVDs if you're in TV. I must have sent CDs to, I don't know, 15 different people within the university and the radio station separately, which costs money, you know, but you have to go all out if you want a gig like that. I had no shot to get that job. And I eventually got the program director of the station on the phone, and I said, I'm coming down to Miami anyway. Will you meet with me? He said, all right. And I was coming down to Miami anyway, but I backed my dates up so I could spend some time pursuing this job. So I met with him, and he said, well, the athletic director and the general manager, I mean, they really all have the most input in this position. So I went down to University of Miami, and I waited outside Paul D's office. He was the AD until he came out to see me. I said, I just want to shake his hand, you know, and I shook his hand and I met him, and that's all that was, you know. But now I know that he knows who I am. You know, I'm not some axe murderer. I'm a guy who wants the job, and, you know, I appealed to him that way, and he remembered me later. And the general manager, I literally stalked him in the parking lot, you know, coming into work, the general manager of the radio station. So I did all I could do to try to get that gig early. And they asked me for more tape, and I gave it to them. And eventually I found out I got the job from a local newspaper columnist who called me, and he said, I think you got this gig. Like, as crazy as that sounds, because it was going to go to a local guy. And so I get the job. And, you know, I bring this up because, you know, I want to tell other people that these jobs are freaking impossible to get, you know, the University of Miami. And they were back on the rise then, Butch Davis and everything. So I get the gig, and I go down there, and it's August already. This is late. And they're, my first day there, they're scrimmaging. And Andre Johnson is on the field, and he looks absolutely amazing. And I said, who's that guy? Number five. That's what he wore in college. They said, oh, that's the next Michael Irvin. But they're going to redshirt him. I'm thinking, why? I said, because we got other players. And they had Santana Moss. They had Reggie Wayne. They had Daryl Jones, who played in the NFL. They had Andre King, who played in the NFL. Those are lesser-known names, the last two guys. But Reggie Wayne and Santana Moss were in front of him. So Andre Johnson redshirted his freshman year. Redshirted. Can you imagine that? You know, they had talent up and down the roster, up and down the field, and they knew it. They knew they had a lot of talent, but I don't think they knew. And that team had Bubba Franks, who had played in the NFL. That team had a bunch of other guys, Nate Washington. They had a lot of players who would eventually make it to the league. And you mentioned some of the numbers. That 99 team ended up losing three or four games. I think it was four games all told. Yeah, they had a three-game losing streak early. They lost to Virginia Tech late, Michael Vick up there. And they were so disappointed. I was thinking, man, you know, like, a winning season, this is great. I'd come from UMass where it was Division I AA, and, you know, football wasn't king there. And Central Michigan before that, football was king there, but how big a king? But they said, you don't understand. Here it's all about championships. And they were right. The next year we lost to Washington early. They lost to Washington early, but they wouldn't lose again for another 2.5, 3 years, you know. And in 2001 they won the national championship. And there's something about being with the Hurricanes. When you get off the bus with the Hurricanes, it's very much a villainous situation. You are the villain. You are the adversary. You are the antagonist. There's no doubt about it. You know, I mean, every team that you play in this world, yeah, of course, when you're the opponent going into their gym, their building, you're going to be that way. But it's extra special with Miami. And even in our league in the Big East, especially in basketball, I really liked Hurricanes basketball because I had a great deep appreciation for basketball, obviously. But Miami in the Big East with Leonard Hamilton coaching them, he's at Florida State now, were really good. And the first year I was there, they won a share of the Big East regular season title and went to the Sweet 16, their best season ever. And it was phenomenal. That might be my favorite season I've ever been a part of, just that team, that season, because going to places like UConn and Providence and just kick their butts, and the Big East hated Miami. They just needed Miami for football. Basketball, Big East, Blue Bloods. And I know, I've seen the 30 for 30. They're not really basketball Blue Bloods because they were an up-and-comer. But, you know, by now, 20 years later, they're the league. And they hated that Miami was doing well. They couldn't stand it. But it was a good time. It was fun to be there.
Well, I don't know if you're having Andre Johnson withdrawals, but, you know, you spent the last two decades calling his games. When he gets into Canton, it's going to be a little bit of a Mark Vandermeer tribute when they show his highlights. That's got to be a day that you're really looking forward to. You've had to think about that a little bit.
I never even thought of that when they show his highlights going into Canton, that I'll be on the call a lot. Because I've seen a lot of highlights lately with him signing to retire as a Texan, and a lot of those calls being played, and it's very flattering. It's wonderful to be a part of that. I mean, that's a great thing about the NFL. They really respect the radio announcer's call, I think, much more than other leagues, other teams, which is understandable because in the NBA and Major League Baseball, the TV play-by-play guys are team guys, and those are home calls. You want the home calls because they're going to get more excited with great things happening to the player. But in the NFL, the only home call is radio. And that's what makes it so special, I think. And that's why I think NFL radio is the best radio sport to call these days. I think, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, no question about it, baseball and basketball were outstanding, especially baseball. I mean, the days before baseball had every game on television, you know, the radio guys were just fantastic in terms of stature and compensation and just who they were in the community. They were the voice of the team. The only way you could get the action of the team. Well, that doesn't exist anywhere anymore. But in the NFL, at least they sort of immortalize your voice on NFL film. So, yeah, it's very cool.
That was the first part of my two-part conversation with Mark Vandermeer. More on that in just a bit. But I want to remind you guys that if you haven't already, don't forget, we're on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. You can email us at lockedontexans@mail.com. Tons of ways to get connected with us. And if you forget any of that, just go to the show description of each podcast. All of it is right there for you. We always love hearing from you. So email us a question. You can even give us an opinion. Record an audio message for us. Either way, we're going to put it on the show. We'll answer it. We want your voice to be a part of the conversation. So email lockedontexans@mail.com. That's lockedontexans@mail.com. Tomorrow, we pick up the conversation with Mark Vandermeer. You're going to hear about his memories from the day he got the Texans job and how he could have taken a much higher profile broadcasting position over the Texans. You might be surprised to hear what we're talking about. Don't forget also to check out Brian Patterson's House of Houston website to catch up with everything going on in Houston sports. It's houseofhouston.com, my Houston Sports Talk podcast. Easy to find on iTunes, most anywhere you listen to podcasts as well. Me and RG, we get into the Astros conversation, LeBron, the streaking Astros, as of when we finished that show on Monday night, 12 in a row, and good stuff there. That's all we got for this show for the Locked On Texans. But as always, thanks for making us a part of your week.
You are Locked On Texans, your daily Houston Texans podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.